Good evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, welcome to our program, Shedding Light on Afghanistan. We're honored to have with us Tamim Ansari, director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop and the author of Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. My name is Joshua Lease, and I'm a program officer here at the World Affairs Council. The World Affairs Council offers a neutral forum on critical international issues and opportunities. To learn more about the Council, hear its programs, or join its membership, please visit our website at worldaffairs.org. We'd also like to thank the Asia Society and the Mechanics Institute, tonight's partner organizations, for their contributions. This program will be recorded for radio, so a special thanks goes to our engineer, Michael Chesney. Now, please take a moment to turn off all cell phones and any other noise-making devices. And I would like to introduce our moderator for this evening. Anya Manuel is a partner at the firm Rice Hadley Gates, a strategic consulting firm. The firm assists CEOs and senior executives at major U.S. companies to expand their business and meet regulatory challenges in key emerging markets such as China, India, and the Middle East. From 2005 to 2007, Ms. Manuel served as special assistant to Undersecretary for Political Affairs Nicholas Burns at the U.S. Department of State. In this role, Ms. Manuel had responsibility for South and Central Asia policy, congressional outreach, and legal matters. Ms. Manuel is a member of the Aspen Strategy South Asia Group and serves on the board of the Center for a New American Security, as well as several startups. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Anya Manuel, who will introduce today's speaker.
Thanks, Josh, for the extensive introduction. I am just here to moderate and to welcome you to the World Affairs Council and what I think is going to be an absolutely fascinating evening with our speaker, Tamim Ansari. He's the author of the book we're discussing tonight, which I had the privilege to read over the last few days, and it is truly an exceptional insight into Afghanistan. And I just have to say a quick word about it, because those of us who deal with Afghanistan from the policy community are often struck by how misleading some of the news coverage is. And so to have Tamim's personal account of being an Afghan, growing up in Afghanistan, and coming back now and seeing the changes is really pretty fascinating. So I encourage you to read the book yourselves. To introduce him, as you know, he is the author of Games Without Rules, but also other books such as Destiny Disrupted and West of Kabul, East of New York. For 10 years, he wrote a monthly column for Encarta.com, and he has published essays and commentary in the San Francisco Chronicle, in Salon, in Alternate, in TomPaine.com, Edutopia, Parade, the Los Angeles Times, and other publications. He was born in Afghanistan in 1948 and moved to the U.S. in 1964, and he lives in San Francisco, where he is the director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tamim Ansari.
Thank you, Anya. Thank you, World Affairs Council, for inviting me here. I'm glad to be here, and I'm also a little intimidated to be in such august company facing such an intelligent audience. However, I will dive right into it because I only have half an hour for my remarks. And I'll start by saying the reason I called my book The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan was to suggest that the history of Afghanistan is not invasions, occupations, and interventions. It has a story of its own, which is often interrupted by invasions, occupations, and interventions. So there is a story there. And there's also a bit of a mystery, I would say, here. The mystery is this. About every 40 years over the last two centuries, some great power, no, not even just some great power, but almost always one of the two or three greatest powers on Earth, has entered Afghanistan to intervene in some way and to dominate and shape the events there. And every one of these interventions has ended badly. And the curious thing is, they've all ended more or less in the same way. And there's another one that's kind of ending in the same way now. There are so many eerie parallels between how it was in 1841 when the British were there and how it is now. So I'll talk a little bit about that. But the question is, the riddle is, the mystery is, why does this keep happening? And the answer that you usually hear, the conventional answer is, the thing is that Afghanistan is really hard to conquer because the people there are so xenophobic and militaristic, and they're warlike and they hate foreigners. And so when an occupying force comes in, they unite like a rock and they beat back that foreigner. Well, I think that's probably not actually true. The truth is, Afghanistan has been conquered many, many times in the course of history, and that's why Afghanistan is what it is. You know, it was conquered by the Persians. That's why most people speak Farsi there. It was conquered by the Arabs. That's why most people, 99% of the people there are Muslim. It was conquered so many times by various Turkish conquerors. It was conquered by Alexander the Great, and so there are bits of Greek genetic heritage still left over in Afghanistan. In fact, I have a cousin who was born blonde and green-eyed, and it's just sort of that pops up from time to time. And she was speaking Greek. No, she wasn't doing that. And what happens is that each of these invaders, traders, travelers, whatever comes through Afghanistan leaves behind pockets. And who the Afghans are the remnants of all these different rivers of humanity flowing through. It's in the last, two centuries that the syndrome has really developed that the Afghans just can't be conquered and these interventions end badly. And what I want to say is that two centuries ago, which is about the same time that the United States first started taking shape, that's really when what we're now calling Afghanistan first started taking shape. And there was an empire. There had been many before, and this was just the latest of those. And a tribal chieftain had cobbled together a big ramshackle area that he controlled. And, in his time, that came to be called informally, somewhat loosely, Afghanistan, the land of the Afghans. Although, in fact, within the purview of his empire, there were not just Afghans, which is another word for Pashtuns, but there were Tajiks, there were Uzbeks, there were all sorts of people, Hazaras in there. What I want to point out is that what Afghanistan was at that moment was a territory. It was not a country. And the people there, even though they may have acknowledged themselves to be subjects of this one emperor, in daily life, nobody really cared who was the emperor and didn't affect them much. And that was the nature of, am I hearing something here that I'm? Oh, that's from below? Okay. I thought I was going crazy, but I'm not. In any case, the people there were not in any sense governed by a central government in their daily life. Their daily life was sewn together by custom and religion. And so at that point, however, that's exactly when the British came to India, and they had a geopolitical rivalry with the Russians. And as things fell out, each of those great powers decided they had to occupy Afghanistan so that the other one wouldn't. And it was the same period that, the remnants of the emperor was trying to consolidate control over that area. And in another time, without the foreigners, the sons would have fought, it would have washed out, and then there would have been a period of no empire, and then some other emperor would have come. That had happened many times. This time, the process of history was such that the power within Afghanistan felt a need to consolidate its territory in order to be able to rule at least that in the face of these outside powers. Now, that was a difficult task and had never been the case with any government in Kabul. After the first British invasion, the fellow that they ousted, they brought back then. That guy's name was Dost Muhammad. They ousted him because they said, the people don't like him. We're going to put in a more popular guy. The more popular guy happened to be a former king of Afghanistan that they were supporting in India. He was living on a pension. They ousted the other guy. They put that guy in. Now I will also mention that the guy they ousted ended up living in India on a British pension while this war was going on. And after the violence that occurred in Afghanistan, the British washed their hands of it at that time and said, okay, we were wrong. The guy we put in is not popular. We're letting the other guy come back in. 40 years later, it happened again. They had a new rivalry was popping up with the Russians, and they decided once again it was important to take direct control of Afghanistan. They came in, it turned into a horror show, and they left. In that interregnum, the few years that somebody actually managed to eliminate the brothers and the cousins and the uncles and assert full control of Afghanistan in the sense that he had unchallenged occupation of the throne, and the country more or less accepted that, okay, the city in which he's living and from which he's ruling is the capital. There's not other little states within Afghanistan. There was a period between the two British incursions that there was a king, and he tried to do some things immediately. He tried to create a post office, write a constitution, and create a national army of guys that would wear uniforms and all look the same, because that's how the Europeans did it, and he felt like if he could get one of those, maybe. Well, when the British came back in 1879, his army vanished. All of that just completely didn't work, and there was a period of chaos, and then the British left again, and they once again handed the reins over to an Afghan strongman. All right, now you get to a pivotal moment in Afghan history. And, you know, those of us who grew up in Afghanistan, we're aware of this guy. We remember him. When I was a kid, this particular ruler who came back in, mothers might frighten their children by saying, you be good now or Abdurrahman will get you. And we knew that this was a tough guy from the past. When I was researching this book, I realized, whoa, he really was tough. He was tougher than I thought. I would compare him to Germany's Bismarck, except that he wasn't such a wuss as Bismarck. and his name was Abdurrahman. And the first thing he did when he came in is he made a deal with the British. He said, okay, you guys, you tell me where the line is. And that line he agreed to was called the Durand Line. That's the southern border of Afghanistan, and that included a treaty arrangement with the Russians who would accept a northern border for the country. So now there were these two fences, and this particular king, he was in charge of what was in between those fences, and his deal with the British was, you know, I'll accept your fences, you leave me alone to do what I want inside the country. And the thing that I knew that is an ordinary thing to know is that, you know, his brothers came at him, he defeated them. His cousins came at him, he defeated them. Other tribes rose against him. He fought 40 tribal wars in his 21-year reign, and he defeated all of those tribes. Then he went to war with the ethnic groups. The tribes are really all Pashtun tribes, so that was within his own ethnic group set of wars. Then he went to war with the other ethnic groups, and he defeated them, and some of those wars were pretty brutal wars. But he defeated them, the Hazaras, the people of Nuristan, and so finally he had conquered everybody within his territory. But that was actually only a very small part of what he did. And that's what amazes me, because, man, you know, if you rule for 21 years and you fight 40 wars, I would usually think that's maybe all you did. but here's the thing. The real challenge for someone ruling Afghanistan was the fact that at the local level, everywhere, the lives of people were governed from the grassroots up by local leaders. Every village had some structure in which the tribal elders were the people with prestige, and they kind of controlled things. The tribal elders worked hand in hand with the clerics, the Islamic clerics. And the tribal elders were not necessarily, or even really at all, they were not elected, or there was no process by which they were given the authority that they wielded. there was no authority to give them authority. It was kind of like, you know, in a family, you don't decide who's going to be the boss of the family. That's just decided within the family. Within the Afghan culture, somebody who had a leaderly sort of role and prestige had to maintain that, not with, also with prowess with arms and being a military strongman. Perhaps that was needed, but much more important, so much more was going on in terms of the politicking within the customs of the culture, which included things like demonstrating your munificent generosity. If you failed at a crucial moment to do that, you were going to lose some prestige and you might not be considered one of the elders for very long. There is a sort of a feeling in Afghan culture that you should be modest about your accomplishments. So one way to be a great, powerful man is to claim you're nothing much and you're just like everyone else. To give you an anecdote, one of my cousins came here and he was working at Voice of America, and he had a beef with some other Afghan guy that worked in the Voice of America, and he said he was going to report this guy for what he was doing. I said, "What is he doing?" He said, "He's acting proud." And I said, "I don't think you can get him in trouble for that." He said, "No, I've got proof." So, you know, so there's a whole web of customary, understood, informal stuff that governs how people become recognized as leaders. And the clerics are the same way. This is also true of Islam in general. But these grassroots local clerics, they just emerge from amongst the people. There is always some people who are known to be mullahs of the village, the basic sort of clerical unit. And mullahs, they go to people's houses and they're fed by them. They lead the prayer in the mosque. If there is a mosque, they might take care of it. And people who want to be mullahs, little boys, they go hang around the mosque and they help out. And eventually, you know, they learn what there is to learn. And eventually someday somebody needs a cleric to come and whisper in the ears of a baby the words that must be whispered to induct them into the Muslim community. The mullah's not there. They say to the helper, "Come, you do it." And then after that, he kind of is. So there's this whole level of Muslim clerics, tribal elders, leaders at the local level. And that's the real challenge to a ruler in Kabul actually governing the country. And this man went to war with the local, with that level of leadership. And he did things like, one of the things he did was he told the people to elect their own, every representative, every village should have a representative. But that representative's job was not to tell the king about the grievances of the people. That representative's job was to tell the king who was not obeying tell the king which of his people were guilty of some disloyalty. But he paid them. So now they are acting as watchdogs for the king. And if they don't, they lose their pay. He appointed then another whole set of officials who were in all the villages, and they were the person to whom the locally elected representative reported to. Now there's this whole other layer of officials, and they're everywhere. He took the mullahs, and he said, "I'm going to give you salaries. The mullahs will now get government salaries." Well, who would reject that? So the mullahs were drawn into the system. Then he said, "We're going to examine mullahs. Anyone who can't pass the religious test doesn't get a license, and mullahs without a license won't be allowed to practice." So, most of them flunked. And then he created his own government-sponsored schools, and people who went there, they could be mullahs. So he created this whole structure that he controlled from the top completely. And he wanted to make that be Afghanistan. But you know what? That other old Afghanistan was in there and was still just immensely powerful and strong. And as a legacy of his time, now there's these two Afghanistans kind of wrestling for the identity of the country, the power, the definition, and control of the culture. So now, subsequent to that, when invaders come in, they always end up intervening in this already ongoing story within Afghanistan. They come in on one side or the other. And over a 40-year period before the Soviets invaded, there was a royal government, a royal family, that artfully, I see a lot of art there now that I didn't see when I was living under it. I saw tyrants when I was living under it. But I look back now and I say, those guys were brilliant politicians, and they gradually really established some kind of a national, a nation state, a country that was controllable. But it still was a wrestling match between an outward-looking sort of secular urban elite, which was being educated in the other countries in the West, coming back, developing, you know, being engineers, running the roads. And there was still, you know, local clerics, local tribal leaders, villagers that was, you know, that was resisting the changes that would come. When the Soviets invaded, it was not a revolution. Let me back up. When the communists took over Afghanistan, that was not a revolution. That was a coup within the urban ruling elite. And it was people who were impatient with the pace of change. They wanted it done faster. They took over. Things went to hell. And then the Soviets invaded. And what they did in their invasion is they decided that the way to win was to depopulate the countryside. And they carpet bombed and landmined and killed the animals and drove out the people and, you know, 6 million refugees. And the legacy of that was a country that was, all of the progress that had been made up to that point was just sort of decimated, destroyed. When those refugees came flowing back, as they have in our day, I think the nature of the culture has been changed by what happened. In that period, the crux of it being the Soviet invasion and the heat of it, the real furnace of it being the civil war that came after the Soviets left and everybody abandoned Afghanistan and left it to its own devices. Now we're there, and I'm going to bring this around to the beginning by giving my answer to the riddle of Afghanistan. The thing is not that Afghanistan is hard to conquer. Afghanistan is hard to govern. And that's the key point here. And when, especially from the West, or a culture that's very different from the culture of Afghanistan, when they come into Afghanistan, the effect is that they make it less governable. And when they take out whoever has managed to achieve authority within Afghan culture and establish another ruler that might be seen as more accommodating to the outsider's aims, and or, you know, more a guy you can talk to, he understands the world, all those kinds of things that you want in a ruler that you're going to deal with in a country. They make that guy unable to achieve the authority within Afghanistan that he needs to govern. So that's what keeps happening. When the British first came in, they didn't lose any wars except that last desperate rush out of the country when they all got massacred. The battles they won. What didn't happen is they couldn't create a government that would be able to keep the country from dissolving into chaos. Same thing happened the second time. Then this tyrant came in, and he took the country by the throat and squeezed it and created this thing. When the Russians came in, that's exactly what happened. The country became ungovernable. The Afghans that opposed the Soviets were not some united force that were hard to conquer. There were hundreds of groups. People say seven groups in Pakistan, but those were only the fundraisers. The actual groups were the hundreds of guerrilla armies inside the country. And something like that is happening again now, and we refer to that fragmentation somewhat conveniently as the Taliban. But I think that's a misleading phrase. How much time did I have left now?
About 5 minutes.
5 minutes? All right. since I know you guys have questions, and we'll get into many things that I can't get into in my half hour, I'm actually going to change course here and talk about one other thing in terms of Afghanistan, and that's the state of Afghanistan today and where it's going and how it, you know, what the prospects are. We're in the busy middle of withdrawing from Afghanistan, supposedly. End of 2014, we're going to take everybody out and all the troops. There's a caveat there, but mainly they're coming out. And the idea is we're going to train an army of 300,000 and a police force, and they will take care of the security of the country. They will protect the country from who exactly? I think it's emblematic that because of the confusion of who the other guys are, we have very standardly fallen into the jargon of calling them the bad guys. Because then you don't have to define who they are. They're the bad guys. And the trouble is, you know, you're creating an army to defend Afghans from the bad guys, and it's not really that distinct who are the Afghans and who are the bad guys. Now, whoever these insurgents are, they have found a way to counter the building of this army. Insider attacks, the green-on-blue attacks, that's a huge problem. However, in my last 2 minutes, I'll say this. Last time I was in Kabul, two things. I was terrified the whole time. It just felt so dangerous. And yet, when I came back, I was exhilarated, and I wanted to just go right back. And here's why. It was so energetic. There is so much going on. There's the one thing you don't experience, and I didn't experience this in 02 either when I went back. The one thing you don't experience being in Afghanistan is a bunch of people feeling sorry for themselves. And you'd say if anyone has has earned the right to say, poor me. But no, what you see is just the most aggressive, everybody on the make, trying to figure out how to take advantage of the situation as it is. Technology is flowing in. Green technology is happening in Afghanistan. Solar panels, little hydroelectric plants, computers in faraway villages, in a way that at least feels more palpable than I feel it to be here. So so what's going to happen in Afghanistan? I'm going to leave that, and maybe you guys will ask a question. I'm going to wrap it up right there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's great to go into the history and understand a little bit of the background here. I have a couple of questions, and one I'll, as moderator's prerogative, combine with my own. Okay. You have this beautiful passage in the book that talks about the recent U.S. efforts to rebuild Afghanistan, and I'm going to massacre it, but it's something like lots of positive things are happening. But each opening of a school, an opening of a hospital, and school graduation is a drop in the bucket, and you need a lot of drops to fill the pool. But just one suicide bombing can destroy a lot of those positive things. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I experienced when I was there working. And so I want to put you really in the shoes of President Obama and the administration now.
Yeah.
And this segues nicely into a question one of the audience members asked, which is, aren't we overemphasizing the military effort and not emphasizing enough the humanitarian and aid effort? Do you think that a reversal of that effort would make a big difference? Do you think there's anything that U.S. policy can do differently that would improve our odds of leaving a more stable place?
Well, I do think that. I think that the military footprint has to come up off of Afghanistan, and that the involvement of the United States in Afghanistan has to be much more, what did you say,
humanitarian.
Humanitarian. I think maybe humanitarian is too emergency-oriented, what that evokes for me. There's reconstruction that needs to be done. Now, here's the thing. I think reconstruction in Afghanistan has been mostly thought of in terms of stuff, you know, highways, concrete, buildings. And the thing that has not been done and that needs to be done and that Afghans have to do, we cannot do it, is the restoration of the fabric of the culture. And you know, there are some things that are being done that go to that. I think one of the things that I am most fond of is the Turquoise Mountain Foundation. You know about those guys? So this is Rory Stewart started, but now it's completely Afghan-owned. And what they do is they work on doing projects that involve master artists and craftsmen within the Afghan tradition. And they set it up so that those guys then are able to be teachers to apprentices, young Afghans who come up and learn, you know, tile work, silversmithing, woodworking, all these different kinds of projects. And they are rebuilding or restoring the old neighborhood of Kabul. Now, the thing that's cool about that, I think, is that very often when someone comes to a devastated place like Afghanistan, the immediate thought is, let's fix it. And what people don't quite appreciate is that the reawakening of the soul of the culture is indispensable to the repair of the body of the culture. And so I think much like that needs to be done. Now, the other thing is, I'm going to give a couple of anecdotal answers to this. I think that our involvement in Afghanistan should be carried out by people who have gone through a great deal of education and training in the language and culture of Afghanistan. People have to be hip to that. And I will say that, you know, at one time I did a little workshop for for some branch of the military here, because it was a good thing. They wanted to learn about the culture. But I told them a bunch of stuff. It was thematic. It was about, things like I told you how leaders are conceived of, and where the role is religion, and how do people feel about that, and why is this separation of men and women, and what do people... So I think that the thematic thing is what I was trying to put out there. And I could see that people were not liking it. They were impatient. This wasn't very useful. And afterwards, a bunch of these guys came up, and they had specific questions. They said things like, is it true that... Now, I've heard that you can't shake hands with an Afghan with the left hand. Is that true? Does it offend them? Because I don't want to offend Afghans. And I've heard you can't sit with your feet pointing towards the door or towards somebody else. You know, it's like, what is that? And I'm like, no, you'll never get enough of those things to pass as an Afghan. And it's not like Afghans are going to say, oh, you'd put your feet towards the door. Afghans, like any human being, look at another human being, will say, I know you're from someplace else, but they expect certain things you don't have to know about. It's instinctive, they would think. Now, it's not, because... last year, last spring, some American servicemen at Bagram took a bunch of Qurans and they put them in an incinerator. And so the thing is, that's not one of those kinds of things where you come up and say, now, what is the rule about the Quran? Can you put it in an incinerator? you wouldn't ask that if you knew what the Quran was for people. And if you knew, for example, which I think very few people do, that the Quran is not analogous to the Bible. The Quran is not a book. You know, the Quran is the only incarnation in the material world of God Almighty. So, so when you're trying to figure out, how do I treat the Quran in this context? It's very easy. You know, try to think of the most elevated thing and just do that. It'll probably be right. So it's not a question of, do you wrap it in a blue cloth or a white cloth? You know, when you are seen to be treating that artifact with the reverence that many Afghans assume is, you don't have to be taught. That's a, you know, so I think our engagement has to be conducted a lot more through people who are educated in that way. So there's that. I'll say one last thing, though. No matter what happens, this is a tough road, and the best things we can do are probably going to result in more American casualties, and that's been one of the difficulties all along. All right.
Thank you.
What else?
Just one added point. That cultural sensitivity is very difficult because a lot of our... We have either six-month or one-year deployments to Afghanistan. And so you're constantly cycling young people through who have maybe had basic cultural training like the kind you did, but really know very, very little. Mm-hmm. And with the best intentions, but know very, very little. A very good question from an audience member is, why is Afghanistan so different from its neighbors? And why didn't the neighboring countries have a similar history of, I assume, invasions and disparate groups struggling to dominate the country?
Yeah. Well, that's a geography question. Afghanistan happens to be the place where, in ancient times, three civilization areas overlapped. The Persian was over here, the Turkish nomadic culture was up north, and Indian civilization was south and east. And this is the place where those influences overlapped. And so Afghanistan has always been none of those and all of those. You know, it's always had some connection to Persianness, Indianness, Turkishness, but it's not any of those. And so all through history, in addition to the Persian Empire and these other things, there's always been some kind of an imperial entity thing in Afghanistan. The geography of ancient times here is that whoever held Afghanistan held the high ground and could come storming down into the plains of India where all the wealth was. That made it a bad situation for whoever was living in Afghanistan and wasn't into sacking the plains of India because people would come through. Now, in later times, it's still the case that that's the place where, that's got to be the line of scrimmage. For the British, they wanted to exert their influence north, but that was about as far as they could get. And the Russians wanted to come south, and that was about as far as they could get. So Afghanistan happened to be the place where the two great armies of the world came face to face and could not make headway against each other. And the people who were living there just got trampled by the elephants. So that's the simple answer to that.
That's great. Thank you. Another audience member asked, you talked a lot about Afghanistan's traditional grassroots governance. What are your thoughts on efforts like the NSP, the National Solidarity Program, which both empowers local structures but also creates relations with the state? And maybe you can just start by describing what the National Solidarity Program is.
You tell me. I'm not familiar with that. What are you talking about?
I think the audience member might know even more about this.
It's
a small aid program that was seen as very, very effective, where essentially local village councils were asked to vote on a project they wanted, and they got something like $60,000 grants to build a well or build a small market road, and it was spectacularly successful, but sort of chronically underfunded. Mm-hmm. And the question is this a good way to go? Should we be doing more of these things?
Well, you know, let me ask a question back. Is this different than the PRTs, you know, the Provincial Reconstruction Teams?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because
it sounds like the audience member involved, because this is not actually my question.
Is this different from Provincial Reconstruction Teams? It sounds great, and if I were asked in a vacuum to say what would be the best kind of program to do in Afghanistan, that would be it. And I really think that in 2002, 2003, if that had been really the massive way in which the reconstruction was approached, that would have been great, perfect. Now, in the intervening period, the insurgency out there that developed, and it's not, I don't want to call it the Taliban, it's much bigger and vaguer than that. With the PRTs anyhow, the thing that turned out is that wherever a small group of people was in a village trying to do something that was useful, that was attractive to the insurgents to come and do their attack there. Because, and I will go back just for a moment to your, you evoked the chaos versus order thing that I'm setting up. The situation is that Afghanistan is full of people who will prosper in an environment in which there's nobody. Okay. In the when all the social order was destroyed and it was a position of chaos. There are certain kind of people who like that because that's good for them. They have the skills that are needed to prosper and rise in that. And the insurgency was largely an outgrowth of people who wanted, first of all, to restore that kind of anarchy, which is the ocean for the fish. They could swim in that, so they want that. And what they had began to discover is that if they did something shocking and horrible that scared everybody and made people think the world's going to hell and we're in big trouble, that promoted the environment that they wanted. So now when you are in a remote area and, you know, a small group comes and does this really good project for these villagers, then these guys know that if they go there and attack it, that will be a that will further their cause. When that happened enough, then at least with the PRTs, I don't know about the NSP, but with these provincial reconstruction teams, which Afghans were, you know, the government was involved in that, when they came around and said, we'd like to build a clinic, villagers began to realize that if these guys come, the war is coming here. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm only saying that in order to indicate that even the good sounding programs, there's ways in which they go awry. I'm not saying that to say that's not a good idea, because really, in the end, that is the way that this is going to proceed, and there has to be some persistence and endurance through the bad things that will happen. That's why I said earlier, you know, there is not a right solution that will avoid some bad stuff. The promotion of the orderly society, which will render impossible the kind of insurgency that we see, requires, optimism about the worth of endeavor, human endeavor, in the face of all the facts. And eventually it could accumulate enough that there could be a tipping point towards faith and order, you know, and so we hope for that. Okay, so.
Thank you. Let me say one additional thing, specifically on the National Solidarity Program. It was, everybody who's worked in Afghanistan believes this was really powerful and a very good program. However, it only solves one small issue, which is the local well, the local this, and there's so many other aid priorities. There is essentially no infrastructure. There is no energy infrastructure, no road infrastructure. You have teachers that need to come in and teach. We, the U.S., to its credit, got 7 million people in school compared to the 1 million that were in school before the war. So those are all things that can't be solved with the small village grants, although the small village grants were great. Another question is on this similar topic, and it's illiteracy. It's been reduced somewhat since 2001, but not very much. Is this one of the more important issues, and should this be a high priority, and would that fundamentally change the situation?
Of course, literacy is huge because it provides access to the information of the world, and without literacy, people are trapped inside the information bubble of the local conservative cleric and tribal elder. So that's important. But I will say this, now with the spread of technology all over the country and with satellite dishes and TVs in the most remote of villages, there's other ways that this information is coming in. I personally love literacy because I think people should read. But I'm also aware that even here where I am, people are reading less and less and they're looking at images and getting their information that way. And you know, there's this thing that I heard about that in the province of Badakhshan, which is way up in the northeast and it's very inaccessible, there's this area where there's no roads that go there. But in the war, the young boys of that area, they went off to the war. Then they ended up as refugees in Pakistan. Then they went to computer schools there and learned about high technology. Then the war was over, they went back to their remote villages in that place. And they wanted to use the skills they had. So they set up businesses that digitized things like you know, the accounting for the local carpenter for getting his lumber, selling his lumber, this turned out to be a good thing. So now these little computer businesses are flourishing in that area. But how are they running computers? Don't they need electricity? Well, there are these little hydroelectric power plants that are almost like portable village-sized things that have been invented. They exist, and these guys, I don't know which guys exactly, but people have been bringing them in part by part on donkeys to these villages and assembling them there. They all have swift-moving little streams. And so now there's electricity in these places where there's no roads. And they get satellite dishes in there. So they have TV sets. And on their TV sets, what do they watch? They can watch many shows that have come out of the television stations in Kabul. And those include talk shows, music shows. You know, I would have to admit that when I was there, a show that I saw, seems kind of horrible, was a docudrama reenactment of the most interesting kidnapping of the last week. Kidnapping of the week.
And actually, maybe you could say one more word, because you have this great passage in one of your chapters on what exactly pop culture is like in Afghanistan. And this is something you never hear in the Western media. And it perfectly exemplifies one of the themes in your book, which is this modern superstructure on a very traditional society.
Refresh my memory. What did I say?
You talked about Tolo TV and the American Idol of Afghanistan.
Oh, well, yeah. You know, they have, some of you may know, this has been now going for quite a few years. They have a show called Afghan Star, and singers come, they compete, and then the audience votes with cell phones, and they winnow out, and eventually there's one single. Each year there's one single, Afghan Idol. But that's one show. There's other shows. I saw one that was like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? There was a copy of that show. And I just want to go back and say the Kidnapping of the Week show, which I like to talk about because it seems so bizarre, until I can tell you that I came back then and I turned on my own TV and I saw Final Witness, a reenactment, docudrama of a horrible murder as seen through the eyes of the last victim. So it's not, it's not Afghanistan. This is, the world has a certain cultural elements that are going all over. But the satellite, the hydroelectric plants, all that stuff, that is a spread of at least information literacy into all parts of Afghanistan. However, literacy is huge, and it's important. And it would be incredibly important for women's literacy to go up dramatically. I think that's where the problem really is. And there's a big bottleneck on that, because during those years when the Taliban wouldn't let any women go to school, no future teachers were being educated. So now when there are schools, there are not educated women to teach in those schools, and the power of the culture is still such that they can prevent girls from being taught by men. So women are studying hard, adult women, to keep one grade ahead of the kids they're teaching. It's a slow process.
It is very interesting for those of us who have spent time in Afghanistan just to understand how there are really two completely different cultures within the same country. So you go to Kabul and you go to some Herat, some of the other cities that are doing well, and you have something that's pretty similar to, I mean, more dangerous, but similar to Karachi or Islamabad or urban India. And then you go to the villages and you have something that's really 800 years behind that. And that's what's slowly changing, and that's what the country's going to have to struggle with.
Yeah, and it's not slowly changing, though. This business of the spread of technology to these small things, this is in 10 years. And part of me says when something changes so drastically, so quickly, there's always some trouble that you have to anticipate with that kind of change. But it's happening.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another audience member asked, after the 9/11 attacks, would it have been more appropriate to do something other than go in and overthrow the Taliban violently? Did we act entirely, was this entirely wrong?
If you ask me as an Afghan, I will say no. I was happy to see the Taliban go. I will say this. The Taliban, that Taliban, which really was properly known as the Taliban, that was an entity. It had a structure. It had minister of this and minister of that. So that Taliban was heavily supported by Pakistan. And to my mind, the crucial element in the overthrow of that Taliban was U.S. action to pressure Pakistan to quit supporting that Taliban. And when Pakistan withdrew its support, those guys washed out. So that, you know, they could have done that earlier, I think, actually.
Without the military intervention.
Yeah, and they could have done that before 9/11. But there was no will to do that before 9/11 for complicated and various reasons. But, okay, so they did that. The Taliban left. And then in the period after that, going to Afghanistan was so exhilarating. It was such a place with such possibility. And many of the things you guys are talking about totally would have been possible then, I think, if they had been vigorously, you know, pursued at that moment. That I think the real mistake was losing that window of opportunity in the first 4 years after 9/11.
Mm-hmm. I think there was this real hope and optimism in Afghanistan, fueled by all of the news they were getting about how much aid was going to come through and what the donors at the Tokyo conference were given. And then the reality is that X amount is pledged, Y amount actually materializes, and Y minus 80% actually ends up in the ground, on the ground, because so much is fed through contractors and by USA and through no one's fault. Very little actually ended up there, and I think it discouraged a lot of folks. So, on that note, are you in the long run an optimist about the future of Afghanistan or a pessimist? And why?
That's, to some extent, that's not different from saying, in the long run, are you an optimist? Because in the long run, I'm both an optimist and a pessimist in this sense. The present is always going to pass away and something different will come. And Afghanistan will go through other periods when it'll be great. That 40-year golden age that I grew up in will happen again. I just sort of feel that there is darkness before that dawn. But I will also say, although it's often said that when NATO withdraws, there will be chaos and the civil war will happen again and the ethnic groups will kill each other, I don't think that's a done deal. I don't really know if that's going to happen, and I don't think people there know. They went through such a traumatic time in 92 to 96, that some people say we learned our lesson. You know, we're not going to do that again. I don't know. So I think, and I also think whether I'm an optimist or pessimist doesn't really matter.
You're in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Right. Just one last question, and that is, Karzai's term as president ends in 2014, and he has said that constitutionally he's not allowed to run again. He won't run again. What's your best guess for what will happen? Are we going to have another democratic or semi-democratic presidential election? Are we going to disintegrate?
Well, that certainly is an interesting question. The course of things was that the first election, presidential election, and the first parliamentary elections were really pretty good. And the second set of both of those were really a lot worse, and especially the parliamentary elections. So that thing did happen. I think that at some level, at some point, Afghanistan has to and will grab hold of the apparatus they've got and make it their own. The problem with parliamentary and presidential elections this last time is that I think in Afghanistan they're not regarded as elections the way we think of them. The significance of winning public office is that you can then be in a position to get to control the money contracts coming in. So the actual who's leader and who has prestige and who has control and who has influence, another system is in play to determine that. That's not how, you know, the elections are not how that's determined. And at some point, the elections and the real system have to get integrated. And with us not being there, I think that's got a much better chance of happening. I will also add, however, that we're probably going to stay there in some way, mm-hmm. and we should.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. I want to thank you very much for these very helpful remarks, and once again say that I really enjoyed your book, and I think our audience members would as well. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Good night.
Thank you all, and I will only say so much to say so little time.